WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, I'm sitting down with Jason Smith, who was recently sworn in as District Attorney for Pender and New Hanover counties. Smith has served in the office for many years, but he's now in charge. And when I asked him what's on his mind as the new DA, he told me, youth violence. It's a difficult issue that seems to defy easy explanation and assuredly defies easy solutions. It can also be a racially charged subject. While youth violence is not limited to any specific demographic, we do see a disproportionately high number of gang-related and gun violence incidents in lower-income Black neighborhoods. So addressing the issue without trafficking in stereotypes or stepping into a white savior role has proved challenging for some. But that doesn't mean the topic should be ignored. I don't claim to have the answers, and I'm not sure any one person will. But throughout this year, I'll be sitting down with people who care about the problem and have something to offer. Now, Smith sees things from the point of view of a prosecutor and the district attorney's office as part of the criminal justice system. That gives him some leverage to convene people to work on the problem, but it also poses some limitations. Not everyone who needs to be part of the solution is going to trust a DA. But Smith is the first to admit that he and his office can only be one piece of the puzzle, one part of the solution. All of that said, violence and crime will eventually, almost definitely, land someone in front of a judge, standing across the aisle from a prosecutor or Smith himself. So his point of view is an important part of this conversation. All right, District Attorney Jason Smith, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Ben.
So before we get into this, I just want to ask how things at the office are going, because I know there was some, you know, there were some stresses around the election, and you're kind of rebuilding a new administration after 20 years. So even with none of that, this would still be a challenge. So how is
it
going?
Sure. Things are going great. I've been in a month today, so, and we've had the holidays. Obviously, people have off on the holidays. It's helped, but things are going well.
All right. So we talked about this when you were on the campaign trail, and we were talking about this off mics. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has preoccupied you thinking about what you would do in the district attorney's chair is youth violence.
Right.
So tell me, what does the issue look like from your point of view before we get into possible solutions here?
Well, it looks, look, I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. I grew up knowing gang members. I've grown up with violence, not necessarily close to me, but I've had friends in gangs. But I watched the, you know, certain gangs coming down and establishing themselves in my school when I grew up, and watched the violence go from there. And look, it's been, 30 years since I've been in high school, and it still bothers me. It still bothers me that I've got friends that are dead because of violence, gang or not. And going, I knew how they were. I mean, I played sports with them. I knew how they were, what good people they were. And you're like, how do you change this? How do you prevent either their incarceration or their death? And it's kind of been with me for the last 30 years. I mean, even as an assistant DA, you think about those things, but not a policymaker. And, you know, I'd meet with people. As an assistant DA, you're kind of reacting to the cases. And I've had homicide cases. I've had violence cases resulting from gangs and youth violence. And, you know, at some point you get tired of talking to moms of the deceased or seeing the families of a defendant that you're trying to incarcerate because of their violent act. And it kind of gets to you. So, you know, now that I am the DA, it's been on my mind of what kind of efforts and initiatives can we put forward as the DA's office, and that has turned into youth violence, and I've kind of informally called it the Youth Violence Initiative, and I've already started meeting with people in the public about how do we prevent kids from committing violence and being victims of violence.
So we're not just talking about, you know, young adults who might be on the wrong track. We're talking about an uptick, or, you know, we don't have hard data, but it appears to be an uptick in, you know, children arrested with a firearm or children involved in a firearm-related crime, or, in situations that, you know, an adult would immediately be looking at some prison time.
Sure, absolutely. Look, we've raised age in juvenile, and I think that's been a good thing. We've had some law changes here recently where, depending on the crime, they still get charged as an adult for 16 and 17-year-olds. But in the last year, and I don't have the hard data, and we've just finished up the year, so we'll get that data. I'll come back to you talking about the data. But we have seen an uptick in weapons possessions by – when we talk youth, I'm talking really juveniles. We've seen an uptick in juvenile crime. We've seen an uptick in juvenile gun possessions and the use of the guns. So that's one of those things you're like, what's causing this? What, as a prosecutor and a dad of four, and I'm like, what's causing – what is causing this uptick, and why – you know, why? What's causing it, why, and how do we counter it?
So I know one part of this, and maybe this is the easiest part, as difficult as this issue might be, is the physical guns themselves. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about we'll get to the behavior in a moment.
Right.
But, I mean, you can't be arrested as a juvenile with a gun if you can't get your hands on a gun.
Right.
So what are some of the pathways that, well, that
are here? We're seeing a lot of youth being in possession of stolen firearms. So they may not be stealing them. I mean, look, there's a black market for guns. It has always been a black market for guns. There probably always will. But where are they getting the guns from? And somebody is usually – they're being stolen from somebody. And then passed around or sold around. So one of the things is part of this initiative is talking to the public at large going, hey, lock up your guns. I mean, why are you leaving your gun in a vehicle? Why are you leaving it, you know, out in your house? And why aren't you locking it up in a safe? We have a duty. And I'm a Second Amendment guy. I carry a gun, but you have to be responsible with that gun. And part of that responsibility is locking it up, making sure it's safe so nobody else can get to it. Look, if they have a cutting torch and they're cutting through your safe, I get that. You've done your due diligence, but that's not what's happening. A lot of guns are being stolen out of houses because they're not locked up in a safe. They're being stolen out of vehicles, which we know it's easy to get into a vehicle, and there's not a safe in your vehicle.
The number of times, and I live in I live in the northern part of New Hanover County, and I would say four or five times over the last couple of years, I've woken up and gone down to my car and seen the glove compartment open or the center console flipped up.
Sure.
And I don't leave a gun in my car, but if I had, it would be gone because they definitely, someone rifled through my car to see what they could get.
Right.
It's shocking when I talked, because I had this conversation with some high-ranking folks at Wilmington Police Department recently, just how many guns are just like that stolen out of cars, some of them with stickers on the car advertising your particular favorite firearm.
Yes. I mean, look, and I say this about social media all the time and talking to youth about social media, you publicize everything about yourself on social media. We're starting to see it on vehicles. Not starting. We've always seen it on vehicles. Political bumper stickers. They can tell all of, that used to be a jury question of mine. What bumper stickers do you have on your vehicles or magnets nowadays? And they would tell you, and you're like, oh, okay, now I know kind of your political affiliation. I know, are you a gun owner or not a gun owner? You know, do you even have kids? You know, because a lot of them have the, here's how many kids I have. And sometimes with names, and you're like, oh my goodness, you're publicizing it. So yeah, you've got that dynamic of law-abiding citizens creating part of the problem. Now we're seeing a lot of this too. And our office does a pretty good job about prosecuting straw purchasers. And we're starting to see a lot more straw purchasers too. And what that means is this. Maybe a youth or somebody who's a convicted felon can't buy a firearm. They can't. So they're using somebody who legally can purchase a firearm, and they're using that person to purchase them a firearm and then hand it straight to them. And that's called a straw purchaser, and it's against the law to do that. So our youth are getting it through straw purchases. They're getting it through stolen weapons market. They're stealing it themselves at times. Some they're buying, but you're going to have to buy it from somebody who's just as nefarious as that person. So
that's the gun side of it. We could get way more in detail about that, but I want to pivot a little bit to, I guess, the behavior side of it.
Yeah.
Right. So what has to happen, or what do you see happening that puts a kid, and we are talking about kids here, puts a kid in a situation where they're caught with a gun?
That's the question, right? We were talking off mic, and what drives a 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old to say, hey, I need to carry a gun. I need to carry a gun to school. We've seen a lot of that recently, too, possession of firearms at schools. What drives a kid to walk down the street with a gun? We're not even talking about using it at this point. We'll get to that. That's the next question, right? But what drives a kid to want to carry a gun? Is it, you know, the cool thing to do? Is it necessary because of, you know, their activities for safety, for defense? Again, though, you can't. That's not a legal reason. But we're talking about what is in the mind of that youth. That's the good question. That's the million-dollar question.
I think a lot of this, too, is shielded from the public because when there is a prosecution, a lot of the times this is happening in juvenile courts. So
right.
It's not public.
Right.
And I see a lot of people in the comment section, which is, I know, a foolish place to go. But I see people speculating with no real, you know, firsthand knowledge. So some people do make the argument that, you know, it's not the kid's fault. They need it because they feel threatened. I hear people blame social media. I mean, when I was a kid, I brought a pocket knife to school because I thought it was cool. I thought I would impress my friends. So, you know, you run that through the Facebook accelerator and maybe this is what you get.
Right.
Or, you know, there are definitely, we've seen some of these kind of frighteningly addictive and contagious, like TikTok challenges.
Right.
You know, bring a gun to school challenge. It's that dumb, but it happens.
Right.
So I do think a lot of this is sort of opaque to the public. I think that's troubling enough. Obviously, a kid with a gun in a school.
Right.
Because it could go so wrong. I mean, there was a situation a couple months ago at a school where, you know, the gun got taken away from the student, but if it hadn't, it could go south real fast.
Real fast.
So let's go there. Then when it does go south, when there is gun violence involving a kid, you know, do you get a sense that this is, that there was like a trajectory that where they could have been stopped earlier?
A lot of times you can't. A lot of times you it comes out of the blue. You're like, oh my goodness, what just happened? But we've seen it in, as you dig into some of these mass casualty events at schools, right? Nationwide, not here, but mass casualty events, Columbine and some of the others, and you spend the years of digging in of who is that person, the signs start to show, right? Oh, he's having, you know, mental health issues here or social issues here. We don't have that luxury of digging into an individual's, motivation as much. Now we can. That's one reason we put, one reason we have a juvenile court and system is you're trying to rehabilitate these kids. And part of it is mental health assessments and trying to get to the root of the problem, right? So there's always a reason. The question is, how do you find the reason? How do you find it quickly to stop that type of behavior, right? Because you're going to have to. I mean, maybe the kid gets out of secured custody and he's back at home. And do we expect him to change behavior at that point in time? Probably not. I mean, most times they're kids. If anybody's been around a kid, you know, trying to change a kid's behavior, it doesn't happen the first time.
Yeah.
So again, we do a good job of figuring out motivations, but how do we, I guess as a community, how do we find what motivates that kid and how do we change it? Changing hearts and minds.
Yeah.
How do we change that?
You know, it's interesting, you brought up colloquially called, school shooters.
Right.
And there's, at least as a layperson from the outside, it seems like a different pathology of young white kid who tends to have, there's similar themes over and over again. Mm-hmm. Versus a young black or Hispanic kid who's involved or who maybe a family member is involved in gang violence.
Yeah.
I mean, the end result is still
the same.
Still the same. A gun in the school, that's terrible. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, I think I see people racializing this, mm-hmm. you know, saying like, well, this only happens to this group of people. This right. only happens to this group. I think it's clear that I don't think anyone is safe from the issue.
No, I don't think anybody's safe from the issue. No matter their race, their and right now their age. What scares me is we can have mass casualty at a school and due to a school shooter, and that's their intention, going there and creating mass casualties. Or we can have it on the streets and, you know, for instance, we saw it in, I think, Birmingham, Alabama, a few months back of there's a shootout down at Five Points South there, and there's multiple casualties. A lot of them were unintended because people get caught in crossfire. So, yes, people are going to say, well, it's a different, you know, different motivation, but again, same result. But when the kids use a gun, I mean, it's an intentional act of you, A, loading the weapon, B, pointing a weapon and you pulling a trigger and you having that desire for the consequences when you pull that trigger. And that's kind of, whether it's a school shooter, whether it's a gang-related act, whether it's a non-gang-related, just your maturity level, you know, you deal with stressors and anger a different way, and some deal with anger through violence, right? They just get angry and say, I'm going to lash out, and now you're lashing out with a gun instead of a knife back in the day or your fist, you know, you're lashing out with a gun. It's what motivates that child to pull that trigger. That's what kind of where my heart goes to, is what motivates it. Because if we can figure out what motivates, can we stop it?
All right, well, we need to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a few moments with more of my conversation with District Attorney Jason Smith, talking about youth violence. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. I'm speaking today with District Attorney Jason Smith. We're talking about the difficult but important to tackle issue of youth violence. Something I've heard from law enforcement, and I had this conversation with your predecessor, Ben David, mm-hmm. about what I kind of sometimes call nihilism, or just this detachment from reality, especially from people who use guns in violent acts under the influence of drugs and alcohol, but even more generally, just, you know, people who are getting ready to commit a pretty heinous act of violence with really a low-level understanding of what it really means. People who drive by and shoot up a house without thinking, oh, what if the person I wasn't mad at is in the house?
Right. Nihilism. No hope and purpose, really.
And that seems to me like if you want to put this all under one umbrella, it's that there's some kind of hopelessness, there's some kind of, you know, underlying issues that, right. And I think those are the things, if you want to change hearts and minds, you say like those are the things you can diagnose, because by the time the kid's in the school with a gun or in the public place with a gun, you know, as a district attorney's office, really all you can do is pick up the pieces and prosecute. That's right. And figure out what to do. So
right.
if we're talking about how do we catch this earlier on before it metastasizes,
we have to give hope and purpose, right? No. And that's even to adults. I mean, I've seen adults walk into court, whether it's drugs or alcohol, or they just have no hope, and they feel like they have no purpose. And that's for an adult who's lived a life and have a little bit of maturity level to them. Imagine a 15-year-old that believes that they have no hope and purpose in life. And that's kind of where we're at, from where you've spoken to people and you're seeing that. I'd love to talk to the kids and say, tell me, do you have hope that one day you're going to have a successful life? And they would say, well, what's successful? I mean, but I think what we have to do is, A, get to the bottom of it is, why are they thinking what they're thinking? Do they have hope? Do they have purpose? And if they don't, how do we give them hope and purpose? You know, I find that people, when they work, like, and I'm not saying this, just generally, you know, people are happier when they work. Why? Because it gives them purpose. They're doing something that gives purpose. You know, that purpose is I'm going and I'm utilizing my skills, whether it's hands or mind, and I'm making money, and I'm making money to pay bills, and I'm raising a family. That's hope and purpose. But you get a kid that says, you know what, I don't believe I'm ever going to, you know, make it out of my neighborhood, or I'm never going to make it out of school, or I'm never going to, does that drive to nihilism? And then, well, if I have no hope and purpose, then maybe it's easier to commit violence.
Yeah, I think economics is one piece of this puzzle. Mm-hmm. That if this community or our communities, because there's more than one, is going to deal with this, economic inequality is one of them. Mm-hmm. I remember being a very young man working in a restaurant. I started at $6 an hour, and I made the mistake of doing the math. I literally did it on the back of a cocktail napkin. I did the math, and I said, if I could live rent free and only ate and drank at the restaurant, and that was it, I could make my first million by some time around my 80th birthday, depending on inflation and if I kept getting, you know, like a quarter raise every year.
Right.
And it was a pretty hopeless moment.
Right.
You know? And then the solution for me was, okay, maybe I shouldn't stay as a burger flipper. Maybe right. I should aspire to more. Right. But I definitely know, and I think a lot of people can remember a time in their life when economics alone made them feel
right.
pretty hopeless. And I've definitely talked to people who think, you know, the answer, you know, not to solely focus on one thing, but for example, right. you know, gang violence in the inner city, you know, in low-income black neighborhoods, low-income Hispanic neighborhoods, the lack of hope, right, that you could get out of that economic, you know, hole is a huge motivator. Because why? I mean, first of all, it makes earning money illegally through the drug trade very glamorous. Mm-hmm. It feels like a cheat code for a video game, mm-hmm. but now all of a sudden you have the things that your maybe family who've worked legitimate jobs don't have.
Right.
But it also feels like, you know, the system is, you know, set up against you and you're going to fail. So that feels like part of it. I've never been convinced that that's the entire answer.
I don't know if that's the entire answer either, because I still see people living in the same place they were living in before they, you know, committed violence to get money or to, you know, illegal drug trade to get or some even have a job, right? And they're still doing the same thing, and they're still living in the same place. And yes, I believe the economics has a part in it. I don't believe it's this. It's something in the. I hate to go back to it, but hope and purpose. I mean, look, you had that. You were going straight from burger flipper, $6 an hour, to a millionaire. There's a lot in between that, right?
Yeah,
and
that's
true. We currently live in that.
Yes.
In that middle part, that middle class, in that middle America where, you know, you can have a job, may not be the greatest one, but, you know, you're able to provide for your family and buy goods for you. Look, everybody's social media does this. Oh, I want to be a rich athlete. I want to be a rich this, a rich that, a rich that. And we kind of lose that. We lose that focus on, you know, that middle class.
Sure.
Life.
I mean, if you're setting the bar for personal success right. as, you know, a global platinum selling artist
right.
or, you know, an Olympic athlete with endorsement deals
right.
out the wazoo,
right.
then, yeah, it's going to the deflation of not living up to that over and over again right. is going to be pretty tough.
Yeah. I mean, that happens. I mean, look at all kids. You know, I told you I have four kids. One of them works, you know, for minimum wage. And she's like, oh, I can't do anything with this. And I'm like, you can. Right now, for your age, you can buy a pair of shoes. If you want to buy a pair of shoes, you can put gas in your car. Yeah, you're not buying a mansion and you're not, you know, going on, you know, eating out every night. But it gives you something.
I do remember the first time I bought someone else a beer with my own money. Yeah. That was kind of nice.
It's kind of nice. Yeah.
I get what you're saying about that. I also wonder, you know, When it comes to some of the motivating factors or aggravating factors, and we're getting into angry grandpa shaking our fist territory, but we got to do it. Because I think there's been some pretty bipartisan agreement that social media can be extremely toxic. Yeah. And that's on a good day.
Right.
So you take someone who's in maybe a despondent place because of some of these socioeconomic reasons, or maybe they've got a troubled home life, or maybe they've got a mental illness.
Right.
Or maybe some combination of all of those. And then you strap this thing to their face for 20 hours a day.
Yeah.
I mean, does this actually come up as part of your review of cases, or is this just sort of in the environment?
I don't see it as much in my in the cases. I mean, we'll hear about it, you know, but not so much. When we get people's phones, we can see their searches and everything else, but I don't know if they're on TikTok for 20 hours. I don't know if they're on Instagram. You can see it if they're talking about it with other people in text messages or they have these posts of, you know, I have no life, you know, I have no hope type stuff. But I mean, nobody comes to us and says, hey, look, here's a mitigating factor in this kid's case is, you know, social media has made him worse. Now, those would probably find out after a year of digging in their past. Maybe that's, and you see it in the shooter type or school shooter type environments, but not as much here. Now, look, do I see photographs of the glorifying of violence? Of course we do. Of gang violence, of drugs. I can't tell you how many times I've seen fanning of money in selfies. And
right.
You're like, well.
People in a Bugatti with a brand new chrome AK-74.
Right. You know, so again, though, do I think that social media has a negative effect on people? Yeah. Can it be used for positive? Yeah. Too much of anything's a bad thing. Right?
Well, yeah. And I think it's easy to overdose and then just keep overdosing on social media.
Yeah.
I think what people are looking for is, you know, even people who really care about this, they are looking for an easier explanation.
Right.
And I think blaming, you know, a gun in the school on a TikTok challenge, even though that does happen sometimes.
Right.
I don't feel like that's the master key either.
That is not the master key. I think that we want the easy answer. I'm here to tell you there's no easy answer or this would have been resolved years ago. I think that it's a hard answer and it's a hard conversation for many reasons. But what I'm trying to do is start this year of let's have those conversations. That's we can't bury our head in the sand because it's not going to go away. It's going to just get worse. We as adults have to do something about it. We as a total community we have to do something about it. We have to come together. And we may be in rooms where we don't look alike, we don't act alike, we don't make the same money, we don't do the same things, but, you know, and there's times maybe I've been on the opposite side of an aisle from you, but we still have to have for the good of what we're trying to accomplish, we have to have those conversations and try to get those hard answers.
I think this is peak grandpa, right? This is the first in this direction. But I think it's got to be said because I don't hear this coming up in conversations a lot. I think people are afraid of going here a little bit. And that is talking about morality or spirituality or work ethic.
Right.
I think those are all hands on the elephant. They're all a piece of a bigger puzzle.
Right.
And I say this as someone who would have absolutely hated hearing this as a 16-year-old. But there's got to be something going on in that sphere, in the inner life of a child who makes this decision, beyond socioeconomics, beyond social media.
Right. It's a heart change. I say it to my kids, and look, we are Christians, we go to church. I always talk to them about, hey, it's what's in your heart? And without getting on my preaching soapbox, but what's in your heart? And that's kind of, a lot of it is, heart filled with anger, you know, well, how do we change that? Or heart filled with lust and heart filled with envy and heart filled with, you know, the pursuit of money. And something is filling your heart.
There's like seven of them, I feel like.
Right. Yeah. I wasn't going to go down. Yes. Yeah. But something is going to fill your desire in your heart. What is that going to be? And that's kind of what when you say change hearts and minds, it didn't say get you a heart and mind.
Right.
It says change your heart and mind because something is in your heart driving you. Something motivates us every day. What is that? Is it for good or is it for bad? And that's kind of where I want to have this tough conversations with people of how do we change the hearts and minds of those that have no hope or have no purpose or have a heart filled with something that is not productive for this community. And that's kind of where we're at.
So the reason I bring this up, and I hear this from people like you who have a Christian background, from people who come at it from a philosophical background. Right. I think these are all, you know, legitimate, thoughtful ways to get at the issue. I think what's important is that you're talking about a child's heart and mm-hmm. mind, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about socioeconomics, there's economic development programs, there's, you know, school to job programs, there's scholarships, there's all kinds of stuff we can do in that space. You know, social media, Josh Dine and every other former attorney general can sue Meta until they're blue in the face. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about that level, I feel like we're at a deeper level than an economic development coordinator or a school resource officer
right.
or anyone else that can get to.
Right.
Here we're talking about family and church and community groups. And I haven't seen them as involved in these conversations as much as I have like law enforcement and economics.
Right.
And stuff.
Well, you remember for the last however many years been implemented this five arms of the starfish and I'm taking it and kind of running with it. We have, let's start with it, government. That's me and police and other, you know, maybe county government. So you have that. You have education, meaning your SROs / teachers and your educators. Then you have your nonprofits, and we see those. And the there are great nonprofits out there that try to tackle this, but they're trying to tackle it alone. Then you have your faith-based community and your business community. And that's kind of where we haven't seen our faith-based community as much in this realm. Guess what? I'm going to be calling them to the table going, hey, who can get in most families' homes? Usually a pastor of some sort. Whether you're a church member or a member of any religious affiliation, usually those people can get into a home and really talk, you know, with families because they have trust, right? People trust a pastor. And I'm not sitting here, again, whether it's a Christian faith, Islamic faith, or another faith, it's all faith-based communities of let's get in and let's try to, again, change hearts and minds. Now, we all have to play together, right? That's the five arms of the starfish have to play together. And that's kind of where we usually rely on our nonprofits. All right, what program do you have nowadays? Our economic program. Well, we can say economic programs, but for a kid, I mean, they can't work until they're, what, 15 now?
Yeah.
But you know what? We can train them to do stuff. We can train them to... I mean, I've got a 16-year-old kid now. He says, "Dad, I want to try a welding course." And I'm like, yeah, "How do we do that?" It may be that you've got a nonprofit that, you know, hey, look, we've got Kids Making It, right? And they're doing Kids Making It does carpentry work all the day long, and I can show you some of the stuff that they've done. They're teaching kids a craft or a trade that hopefully will stay with them forever, right? So there's things I think we can do over those five arms. That if we come together and put our heads together and it's not relying on just one, you know, you talked about, you know, a savior mentality. I don't want to be a savior mentality. What I want to do is bring all these together and say, all right, we work together as a community. The community can save these kids.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you're referencing off mics. I was talking about one of the issues I've seen in this space is white men and sometimes white women.
Yes.
Who mean well, hearts in the right place, right. have entered this space of community safety or public safety or whatever you want to call it, gang violence, youth violence, mm-hmm. and have not treated the black community as equals,
right.
or more importantly, let them take the lead.
Right.
You know, say, how can I be a facilitator? How can I support you?
Right.
And saying, I'm going to fix this. And I think that has, you know, again, no matter how good of a place their heart is in, that has sort of foreclosed the conversation and
right.
shut stuff down
right.
before it starts.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's not...
And same for the religious approach. I think there are people who haven't brought religious communities into it. I mean, I'm not a religious person. It
right.
wouldn't be my choice for my kid, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't work for a lot of kids.
That's right. And it may not work. And your kid may not be a carpenter. Some kids making it may not work for, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Some just don't have that skill. But when we're talking about organizations out there and parts of our community out there, we kind of designate those five grand organizations. types of organizations that can reach out to a family unit, to a kid, to, you know, to others, and try to change hearts and minds. And we're not, look, it may not work with a kid. It may work with an adult. So, you know, and we see that, we do see that a lot. And so not everything may work, but we need to have the conversation. I guarantee there's some faith-based leaders in there, because I've been to funerals that have known the kids or known the adults who they knew them since they were in their teens, and they knew their troubles. Why? Because usually teens will go to somebody that they can trust and, you know, with, hey, this is what I'm having trouble with. So kind of where I'm going with the faith-based community of they usually are the trusted ones, usually.
Yeah. So. I also feel like sometimes people are afraid to sound Pollyannish.
Right.
Because, I mean, again, I think it's accepting that no one thing is going to be the magic bullet. It's probably helpful.
None.
You know, for me, it was punk rock. That would probably not work for a lot of kids. They'd be like, what is this garbage noise?
Right.
But for a kid, there's got to be, the hope is that there is something,
there's
someone.
I feel like everybody has a purpose in life. You just got to find what it is.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, and we'll be back in just a few moments with the conclusion to my conversation with District Attorney Jason Smith. We're talking about the difficult issue of, and maybe some possible solutions to, youth violence. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. You've been listening to my conversation with District Attorney Jason Smith as we work our way through the issue of youth violence. In this last segment, we talk about who else should be at the table and what role the District Attorney's office can play. So here's my question for you as District Attorney, because the District Attorney's office has a bit more discretion and a bit more flexibility than just, you know, law enforcement officer on the street.
Right.
You know, I feel like a lot of cops, they're given a hammer and asked to fix a lot of problems.
Right.
You know, and the more we ask our deputies and our cops to be mentors and social health workers and first responders, and again, we're mostly just giving them a hammer with some rudimentary hammer training.
Right.
That's a tough situation. You've got a little more leeway, but you are still part of the criminal justice system.
That's right.
So
that's,
what are the limitations that you...
Well, the limitations is I can't save the world, right? Because I am on the opposite side at times of either a youth, the family, something. So that's why I'm not here going, this is what I'm going to do. Here's what we have to do is what I can do, because let me tell you, as a DA, I see two counties right now, and I can see it from, you know, a mile above it and say, oh, I'm seeing a trend up here in Pender. I'm seeing a trend downtown. I'm seeing a trend at the beach. I'm seeing a trend in this high school or this high school and this high school. So I kind of see, and I talk to every law enforcement agency in our jurisdiction. So I kind of see it all. So I'm kind of one of the only people that is able to see it all, right? Because you have different governments, they may not be talking as much about the trends, at least in the public safety realm. So if I can say, hey, this is what we're seeing, here's the trend we're seeing, gun violence here, maybe it's downtown or maybe it's at the beach, or if I can say, here's the trends I'm seeing and here's what we're being involved with, who can we bring in? And it's easier when you're the DA to call somebody and say, hey, we need help on this, right? We need help on this for crime prevention. We need help on this. Will you come to the table and let's try to help? It's a little bit easier. So what I see, my limitations are I can't do it by myself. The trust factor, like I said, most people trust the pastor. Most people do not trust A, an attorney, and B, the DA, right? So we're coming in behind, you know, the eight ball on that one. However, what we're good at doing is building teams and building people and groups and efforts. And that's kind of where I see it happening. Spearhead that, the effort, and bring them together to the table and say, hey, Here's what we got. Here are the trends. Here's, by the way, here's the stats.
Yeah.
And how do we solve this? How do we, what are your ideas? And what are your ideas? And what are your ideas? And say, all right, how do we bring all these people together for the common good? We have, if we don't do anything, it's going to continue to get worse. I'm sorry, it is. So that's kind of where I see myself and my office.
So I know there's been sort of two iterations of this. There was the True Colors approach and the Port City United approach. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that worth another try, set up a different way?
Probably in a different way. You know, I've told you this on and off, Mike. I don't agree with active gang members being used as mentors, because you are still, I believe, you're serving two opposed communities, right? You're trying to stay loyal to your gang organization, but you're also trying to stay loyal to your community. And I think it's hard to serve two bosses. Can't do it, right? So I think that needs to change. I believe that's why True Colors really failed, and I believe that's why PCU failed. You know, what does it look like? I think we need to come to the table and have that conversation of what does it look like without that. And I'm sure there's – look, somebody in the United States has tried something different, and it's working. We need to find who those are.
Yeah, I think some of the people I heard from – in the black community after PCU was defunded, focused more on the fact that the program had gone away and less than maybe I would have on some of the flaws in the program.
Right.
But I think both the general population and specifically those people who are living in sort of high-risk areas would be open to another approach. I've spoken with some of the folks at Cure Violence Global in Chicago, where this thing started, who suggested a much different looking bench of people, including, yes, former felons, maybe people who had been in the gang life,
right,
and left,
right,
but also, to your point, pastors, local barbershop owners, local business owners, mm-hmm, basketball coaches, football coaches, people who...
Who've been successful doing, you know...
And who have a pre-existing relationship.
Right,
And some respect. It's hard to get kids to respect. You have four kids. You know this. It's hard to get kids to respect you.
Yeah. Yes. But you know what it calls... takes persistence, right? Show them the right path. And I mean, a barber can show somebody the right path. Pastor can, you know, a business owner, somebody who's been in a gang but now turned away from it, they can show them, you know, a path to succeed. So, I mean, guess what, Ben? You get to come to the table. And you can come to the table too. You know, it's not just, you know, those five. So, I think we need to take a look at something different that's not PCU and not True Colors. And I've said it, and I've say it to anybody that asks, we need to bring something. What is it? What it looks like, I don't know yet. But yes, we need to fill the void.
So here's my last question, because I think at the broadest level we're talking about, whether you call it public safety or community safety, and I keep asking people what that means to them. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean this disrespectfully to those people. I think everyone has their own definition.
Right.
So I think it's just interesting to hear from people what they think of when they hear those words. So what do you think of when you hear of public safety?
Well, I think some people think of public safety as I'm safe in my personal safety of me and my family. Here's, as the DA, when I think of public safety, it's I'm tired of having conversations with parents of anybody that's been killed. I'm tired of looking over the aisle and seeing a defendant, old or young, and their families behind them. When we're talking about public safety, is being able to walk down the street and not have to worry about, am I going to get mugged? Am I going to get killed? Am I going to get raped? Am I going to get kidnapped? Am I going to be approached by somebody trying to harm me or selling drugs? Or public safety is, I want to be able to live in my house without a drug dealer sitting on the corner, you know, a block down, and worry about who's coming in my neighborhood to buy the drugs, or who's coming in the neighborhood to take over this territory because I live in that territory. So public safety for me is less personal. It can be personal. I'd love to walk down the street and not have to worry about those things, but mine is less personal. Mine's more for the common good, the common everybody, you know, the common community. It's cliche, but that's kind of how I see it. You know, would I love to work myself out of a job? Absolutely. It's never going to happen. I realize that, but we can reduce crime, right? We can reduce the violence. And that's where we got to start somewhere, and that's why I'm talking about youth, you know, youth violence initiative.
So let me leave on this note then. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, it is always going to happen, mm-hmm. right? We have got some tremendous personalities in this county who want to do good. Mm-hmm. We have a boatload of resources. Still, there will be kids who choose violence.
Sure.
So we were talking about this off mics, and I think it's in a way at the heart of all of this is that it is your job ultimately to hold people accountable mm-hmm. as the state of North Carolina when they break the law.
Right.
But I feel like you're at cross purposes sometimes because you would also like to see some of these kids get out from under what they've done.
Sure.
So every DA has to handle this their own way. You are in certain ways, you know, restricted by the law, but how do you see that tension with regards to youth violence here?
Well, we have to, number one, if we don't hold people accountable, then they're going to say, oh, I can do whatever I want. There's no accountability. We've seen that. I mean, you've seen it out west at times with different types of crimes, but we have to hold people accountable. What I want to do is more of the crime prevention of let's stop it before it happens, because when it does happen, you're going to have to be held accountable in some way. However, depending on the nature of the crime, you know, we can rehabilitate. That's why we have a juvenile justice system. That's why we have not everybody's being thrown in prison for, you know, every crime. If you look at our structured sentencing, you've got murders, life without parole or death, and it goes down from there. And some of them are mandatory prison sentences. Some of them are probationary sentences. And while I've, you know, as I was campaigning, people were like, throw everybody in jail. Well, you can't, because the law doesn't provide for that, but it also is not the right thing. The right thing is try to rehabilitate when you can, depending on the severity of the crime and really the person, you know, and that's what we look at. That's what we look at for any case. What is their criminal background? What is the crime that they've committed? And a lot of them involve victims, so what makes the victim whole also? So we still will have to do that. What I'm talking about on this is, look, we're trying to prevent the crime. Now, look, what's going to happen tomorrow when we pick up a youth with a gun? We're going to try to change his heart and mind. Now, he's going to be held accountable in some way for that, but we've got to take – now he's kind of – he has to listen to us, right? Or at least he has to pretend like he's listening to us. We have his full focus because – we're trying to now maybe mental health treatment. Maybe it's, you know, educational requirements. Maybe it's job requirements. I mean, that's what probation's about. Does it work all the time? No, it doesn't. But that's what we give second, third chances at times. To the point of people look at us and go, you're giving too many chances. Well, depends on who they are, right? Depends on what, is this their first time or is it their 10th time? You know, are they a habitual felon or not a habitual felon? We'll continue to do that. Really what I'm talking about is crime prevention and preventing it from ever happening. And when we talk about that, we get in the heads of middle schoolers and get in the head of high schoolers. Because when they're 25, you don't get a captive audience.
They may have made their mind up about
that's
a district attorney at that point.
That is true. That is true. So.
Well, it's an important conversation. I know that this is not the last word.
Absolutely not.
By any stretch of it, but I appreciate you being here.
No, thank you, Ben, for having me.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Newsroom. Thank you to my guest, District Attorney Jason Smith, and to WHQR's Ken Campbell for technical support. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at WHQR.org or get the show as a podcast, pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts. If you have thoughts or comments about today's show or ideas for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.